Many of you know John Patrick, but if not, John was raised in England, got his medical degree there, was an associate professor of clinical nutrition in the Department of Biochemistry and Pediatrics at the University of Ottawa for 20-plus years, retired from there in 2002. In fact, John says I screwed up his life because I heard him on a tape speaking in Canada, and we had him start speaking in the United States, and that grew so quickly and so big that he actually stepped down from clinical medicine and now kind of is a modern-day C.S. Lewis, just enlightening and challenging, give us new insights into God's Word and what's happening in the world. Let's hear what he has to say about these days. John, it's great to have you back on Christian Doctor's Digest. And always my first question I love to ask is, what have you been reading? Every time I see you, got a book in your hands. So.
Of course. Why not? Well, there's a couple I've just been reading of late, both by Rodney Stark from Baylor. One called For the Glory of God and the other called The Victory of Reason.
What did you find in them you liked?
Well, a lot. I happened to run into a friend in Ottawa just a couple of weeks ago when I started reading them. And he said, oh, I was at graduate school with Rodney Stark. I said, unlike most academics, he writes very lucidly. He said, well, he was a journalist before he became a professor. And what he's done is very good. He taught me something that I thought everybody knew. In other words, he taught me that ignorance was wider amongst academics than I realized, in that one of the reasons for writing The Glory of God was that he thought that people didn't know that science was very dependent upon Christianity. And he says, when I started researching, I discovered the historians of science knew that and said that. But he said, I went on writing it because all the people in the soft sciences don't know that. And he does a very good job of it, pointing out that, you know, science has its roots long before the Enlightenment. I refuse to call it an Enlightenment. It wasn't. Way back in the 13th century. And he tells the story very well. And that if you didn't have a God like our God, you would never do experimental science. Where you came from in Africa, it's impossible because evil spirits and experimental science cannot fit together.
Right. There's no logic, there's no reason, there's no order. It's the spirits control it.
That's right.
Yeah. So a good read for docs who want to kind of refresh their...
Yes. And the other one, the Victory of Reason, takes capitalism back to starting in the monasteries in the 8th century. It wasn't Weber and the Protestants. A nice story, he said, but actually not true. It goes deeper than that. And also to talk about the nature of freedom and how Christianity led to freedom. So he deals with slavery as well in The Glory of God. And lots of history well told. So very readable and lots of stuff for us to mull over.
Is he a historian? Is that his...
He's a sociologist.
Well, that's interesting.
So it's an unusual sort of book. But exactly the sort that you could give to lots of your unbelieving friends. Because it's not preachy in any way.
Right. Just here's the facts.
New York Times reviewed The Victory of Reason there. This is what the New York Times said. Provocative. Rodney Stark is to be commended for celebrating the rational element of Christian religion and culture, a part that deserves celebration and needs to be recovered.
Wow.
Newhouse wrote, every once in a while a book comes along that not only provides new answers, but also transforms the old questions. The Victory of Reason is such a book.
Wow. Got a twist of the words nice there in that endorsement.
Yes, very nice.
Let's talk about conscience. That's still, you know, as we look down the road, I think the most important issue we're facing, because if we lose that, we're out of business.
Yes. And I think you and others, especially the Catholic bishops and like, have done a great first-round job of holding back the worst of the Freedom of Choice Act. But it's still sitting there as a time bomb that could go off at any time. So I think the politics side of it was handled astutely. I, of course, am much more concerned about the philosophy that's there. And what do we need to do to point out that freedom of conscience is in everybody's best interest to a degree that will make a real difference. Now, as you know, what we've done is we've set up a registry of Hippocratic physicians because I think this is not by any means just a Christian issue. The issues that are at stake matter to all the world's great religions. So we ought to be able to build a pretty wide consensus on this. And people are signing up, but clearly most doctors are still too busy being doctors to think mm-hmm. about what would happen if this went through. And it's not only the US. There was an attempt made in Canada via the Human Rights Tribunal, which was stopped. There was an attempt in Britain that was only stopped by other political disasters that made it absolutely unnecessary to try anything that might not work.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, it's been tried and worked in the state of Victoria, where doctors' rights of conscience have been taken away. I've been to Jamaica twice in the last 18 months because there's draconian UN attempts to force really vicious pro-abortion legislation through. So this is a worldwide thing. The anti-Christian element of those that rule is out of hand. The right. Germans, for instance, won't allow homeschooling. You've had a German family get political asylum in America from Germany because father was sent to prison for not allowing his children to go to sex ed class at school.
Wow.
So freedom is under attack.
Yeah.
And I always thought Americans were really concerned about freedom, but it doesn't look to me as though they're concerned enough.
Right.
And of course, if a government can get to the stage where more than half the population are dependent upon the government for their sustenance, they might be very difficult to shift.
Right.
So
you bought the votes,
so
to speak.
Yeah, that's right. And the church has done a very bad job over the last 50 years. The evangelical church, which is most of our members, the Catholics have been much more wise. I mean, if you go and look for some theoretical basis for arguing these cases, you're much more likely to find it in Catholic encyclicals than you are in anything written by evangelicals, sadly.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to talk about the fundamentals more often and more completely. The four that I think we need to make the major focus is very simple. The first one is, would you trust a doctor more or less if he thought he was going to be judged after death for his actions towards you? Well, that's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's in everybody's interest that their doctors fear God, or at least fear judgment after death. Why wouldn't a Darwinian kill you if he could get your money without anyone finding out? And I often say to students, I could have a meal with you, you would die, I would not, and there'd be nothing to find at post-mortem.
Mm-hmm.
That would make a pretty good detective novel, except that I don't think the detective could solve it. Doctors can kill, and only an idiot will be caught. Most
right.
of the doctors who get into this and find themselves addicted, in the end, they cry for help by doing it so explicitly, like that British GP who got somebody to change their will in the morning and kill them in the afternoon. I mean, how blatant do you have to get before you're stopped? So it's a real risk. The second one, of course, is that most students think at first sight that you can get from the physical facts to the moral injunctions, and you can't. And that point needs to be hammered home. In our society, there is no means of connecting physical facts to moral injunctions. The way I normally illustrate that is to, in this case, use you as the victim. Imagine that you had cancer, and imagine that I had discovered a cure for your cancer last week, and I have it in my pocket. Ought I to give it to you? Now, of course, the first response is, of course, yes. And I say, but what if I'm a really well-thought-out Darwinian, and you're a wealthy man, and I inherit your estate when you die? Now what ought I to do?
Mm-hmm.
It's the opposite. So what you believe really matters. So that recognition that medicine is a moral activity and therefore needs a moral consensus is very important and needs a lot of development. Because what I think needs to happen, will have to happen to the healthcare system if we are going to be democratic and if justice is to prevail. Well, secularists are rationally going to demand and get both euthanasia and abortion and all these other things that they want. But by the same token that they get it on grounds of representation, so do we get our system, which will not provide abortion nor euthanasia. What happens then in terms of funding is that in our situation in Canada, where the government provides the money, their duty is to find a just formula for funding the system. And amazingly, this will provide us with competition within a nationalized system.
Mm-hmm. And people can vote with their feet like they did with Hippocrates.
That's right. That's exactly what will happen. So that needs to be discussed. The Hippocratic Oath was taken at the commencement of medical training, not on graduation.
Right.
And he said, I won't teach this art to anybody who doesn't share my moral stance. Now, this is anathema to the ACLU. But their position is religious, too. Secularism is a religion, based on the fact that they say, I don't need God to live. Well, that's your position. You want no God to live, and don't blame God for anything that happens. But it's a religious position. You can't prove that it's true. And then, of course, the next one is the sanctity of life. And the final one is, unless you want your family to be cared for by a doctor without moral integrity, then the doctor's moral integrity happens to be higher up the order of goods that are necessary for medicine than in many other parts of life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never had anyone anywhere defend themselves against those positions. In other words, maintain the opposite is true. And so what we need is civilized discussion, less threats, and a more discussion about what do we do. And on our side, we can't just go on and hope it won't happen. We ought at the very least to be setting up committees in any large city to say, if it comes to this, which hospital are we going to take over? What's our plan going to be? Because in the chaos that will ensue, anybody who's organized and can say this is how we're going to do it is going to get what they want. Hospitals will probably be available for a dollar because the insurance companies are always looking at whether their money is better off in healthcare than somewhere else.
Right.
I don't think they'd have any compunction of getting out fast if they saw better profits elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, if there was major chaos as to who's looking after the healthcare system, they might want out.
Speaking of healthcare, what do you think about reform looking down from the north towards us and what's gone on in the country and the theater we have provided so far?
Well, reform is certainly necessary. Right. I think it looks to me from the north as though one group of people who ought not to be victimized are, and that's the working poor.
Mm-hmm.
It looks to me that the working poor, if they get sick, have to become the indigent poor before they get money. In other words, you have to go bankrupt and lose your self-esteem. That's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody can pretend otherwise.
Right.
How you do it is the next question. Now, I often say, you notice that in Canada, the place where this started was the prairies.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they had something going for them. Saskatchewan was dominated by Mennonites. They did not abuse the system. They had high personal ethics. Now, given the movement of populations in the world at large now, there are a lot of people coming into our countries that don't share those stories. They have ethics, but they're different ethics. And for those of you listening, if you've never tried to do medicine in a Muslim environment, for instance, you have a new experience awaiting you any time you wish to try. The will of Allah can get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because Islam is a much more fatalistic religion than Christianity. So they give up more easily.
Wife, just a child.
Yeah, you go to a pagan one, it's even worse, isn't it? You and I have I certainly heard it, I'm sure you have. I could buy a new wife for the price of that operation.
Yes.
That's a different culture.
Younger, prettier, and can do more work.
Yeah, that's right, or whatever, yes. So, we need to think about what are the underpinnings. What we're doing at the moment is proposing technological or financial means to control for what are really moral problems. I think some form of health account is going to have to come in throughout the Western world.
Mm-hmm.
That you have a basic safety net and a health account. And if you don't spend your health account, I think you should be allowed in due course, as long as it's kept at a certain level, to transfer that money into, say, the education of your children or your old age pension, mm-hmm. Tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an incentive to save, and it would be a reward for careful living. I think catastrophic illness should always be covered. But the big one, and how this can be managed, I don't know, although the Brits and some of the Europeans have already started on this. I know that in Britain, for instance, you can't get your carotid arteries operated on the NHS if you're still smoking.
Hmm.
You pay for it yourself. And I think that's fair enough in many ways. We need to say to people, here are various things that you are doing to yourselves. If you want to go on doing this, you need to take out extra insurance. We can only do it, of course, where we can measure it. But, say, alcohol, we've got good enzymes measurements where we can say, you're drinking too much. If this enzyme stays at this level, you have to take out extra insurance. We're not going to cover this. Smoking we can handle, drugs in many ways. Anal sex is bad for you whether it's hetero or homo.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that, extra insurance. I think we should be pressing for much more work on the relationship between costs and behavior.
Well, you know, we talk about the seven key principles of healthcare behavior and how you do reform, and you've hit on two or three of them right there, because I think that's definitely the direction we're going to have to go. The healthcare savings account thing has amazed me, John, is how our behavior and our staff has changed since we went that way.
Really?
And how my behavior has changed.
Even you? You mean beyond redemption?
I'm not beyond redemption, apparently. But I mean, just the thought, I mean, before when you know, Jody's had most of the medical problems, the family, you know, well, the doctor did something, insurance paid for it, they paid for it, well, you know, I'm not over there sweating about it. And then all of a sudden, it's coming out of our healthcare savings account, and I'm saying, why is he ordering that test? And
yes.
What's he putting you on that for? And
yeah.
Why that last, you know? And you begin looking at it, and it's not just those who have medical training. I mean, everybody in an organization is very much more carefully looking at how their healthcare dollars are spent. And so, you know, and I think the analogy I've seen, too, is healthcare insurance is so different than any other kind of insurance. My car insurance, that doesn't pay for me to have my oil changed and my tires rotated, but we expect that in healthcare.
Yes.
And so that idea of turning real insurance into catastrophic issues and then turning a healthcare savings account to help with routine things, and you actually have a reconnection of personal responsibility in that whole mix, I think is definitely something that has to be contained in this whole thing. Or if not, I mean, you talk about cost being the focus, but the bottom line is cost is what's going to sink this ship.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, I was in an interview a week or so ago, and somebody asked me about, you know, getting more access for everybody. I said it's kind of like discounting tickets for the Titanic. Let's get everybody on board.
Before we sink.
Yeah, and then nobody pays any attention. We have a rip in the hull, and the ship's going down.
Yeah.
And they're having a party on the poop deck saying, hey, this is great. Look, everybody's on the ship. And so we've got to deal with the cost issue, or we're not going to get anywhere.
Well, that's deeper still than just medicine.
Yeah.
In the meltdown over the last couple of years is ethical failure on two fronts, both the people who were selling what are clearly unethical products and the agencies on the government side that were supposed to be controlling it who didn't in the US.
Right.
Now, in Canada, we didn't have any banks that needed bailing out.
Right.
Because the government did its right side and there was less trade in hedge funds.
Right.
Interestingly enough, the best description of this problem I came across is absolutely superb on YouTube, of all places. Two British comics, John Bird and John Fortune, worth looking at on the Great Meltdown. They understand it's an ethical problem, and they got it before it happened, at the beginning of 2008. Now, the other person I want to talk to you about today, since I thought I had, but we haven't, is Robert Fogel at the University of Chicago, who's an economist, a Nobel Prize winner. Way back, he's about 80 now, I would guess. But a little while back, I found myself, to my surprise, doing grand rounds at the University of Chicago Medical School. I'm not a currently trendy scientist, so it was a bit unexpected, but I had a wonderful time, and they take it very seriously. It's more than just the one-off grand rounds lecture. You teach the residents and go on a few other rounds. And one of the things they do is ask you, is there anybody in this great university you'd like to meet? And I said, well, actually, there is, Robert Fogel. Can you arrange that? And they said, yes, we can, actually. And it happened. Now, Robert Fogel is a secular Jew who, economist, Nobel Prize winner for the first Nobel Prize for econometrics, measurement in economics. He grew up in New York and spent most of his life in Chicago. But a few years ago, before the meltdown, a book of his came into my hands called The Fourth Great Awakening. Which I didn't expect to find written by a Jew. And to my astonishment, reading it, here was a very sensitive account of the contribution Puritan thought made to America, and Jonathan Edwards, and even Finney.
And that is going pretty far.
It's going pretty far, yeah. And he says that he thinks the Fourth Great Awakening is underway. Now, the thesis of the book, from my point of view, is that he's saying that there's a problem with future flourishing in America, from his point of view as an economist. And it is not going to be fixed by the university, nor in fact by the financial system, nor by technology. because the deficit is in the area of virtue. And he gives his list of virtues in the book. They're not exactly ours, but I can certainly work with them. I'll just read them quickly. There are 15 of them, but they're in order of importance, and the last one is self-esteem. You need just a little touch, not much. But the first one he puts on the list is sense of purpose. What is your life about? What are you here for? And if you don't get that right, your nation won't flourish. And your founders and the great generation and all the rest lived lives which were deeply informed by Christian ideas of duty and law, and Jewish ideas. He says you need a vision of opportunity. If you lose hope and don't see any opportunity for the future, you're in trouble. You must also have an astute sense of what matters next, what's important. We as Christians are often very good at things that aren't important, and we refuse to engage the ones that are. Luther commented on that when he said, if I'm a good soldier on every point except where the devil is attacking, then I'm a very bad soldier. And I think, for instance, today in our churches, there are lots of evidences that we are very bad soldiers because we are not defending where Satan is attacking. Fogel goes on to say, you must have a sense of what work is about. You must have a strong family ethic, a sense of community, a capacity to engage with different groups. You must be benevolent. You must have a work ethic, a sense of discipline, a capacity to focus and concentrate, a capacity to resist the lure of pleasure, a capacity for self-education, a thirst for knowledge, and appreciation of quality. Now, those are
very unique virtues, but you can't argue with them.
No, and they're very deeply Jewish and Christian, but other great religions have them too. But his point, of course, is that you learn these before you go to school, if you learn them at all. The teaching of ethics to 23-year-olds is a waste of time. They may become competent at ethics, but they won't be ethical. Your mum and dad do that to you. If you're ethical, don't take the credit. It's not you. It's a gift you got from your parents and your grandparents, your family history. That's what Deuteronomy teaches. If you love, the effect goes 1,000 generations. If you disobey, the effect there goes for third, fourth, fifth generation. Moral consequence is writ large in the Old Testament, but the modern world wants a consequence-free life. That's Seinfeld.
I'm going to tread on some dangerous ground here. What is the effect of more and more mothers working, less time in the home, more daycare centers done to that?
Well, it's huge. The question I usually ask when people are wanting to defend their use of daycare, I say, well, if your wonderful professional daycare person didn't see your child again from 6 o'clock tonight, would they lose a night's sleep? If you didn't, would you? That's the difference. Now, we actually know, in Canada, the pediatricians have looked at this, and they said anything more than 20 hours a week outside of close family care is measurably bad for the child's development. And of course, from a medical point of view, you put children in a daycare, what do you do to their infection rate? It goes up by a huge amount, and that also inhibits development. So, no, there's no question this is not the best way to go. In fact, I think from the nation's point of view, if you want to put some money into the economy and get people who are not working back to work, put the money into child allowances so that people who would like to bring up their own children can afford to do so. Christians, they need sometimes to learn to live a little more simply, but they won't regret it. We all know. Those of us who had the pleasure of coming home to mum know how different it is for those that don't come home to mum. I think in the second decade, it's very clear that they need much more father influence, especially the boys. And one's beginning to see the younger generation share these things much more than we did, and much better.
Yeah. I think that's a place where you see a lot of progress, where
huge
fathers are much more involved with their kids, especially during their teenage years.
Where fathers exist at all.
Right. Yeah, if they exist.
Certain
then that's
subsets
the other side
of your society, 60% of them don't even know who their father is.
Right.
And that's a disaster of the first order. That's asking for criminality to be the response. Boys need kicking into shape by their dads every now and again.
Right.
And it's not happening. So, yeah, it's a huge issue.
So how was your meeting with Fogel?
Well, I went in and I asked him, why did you write this book? And what did your fellow Nobel laureates make of it? Well, the fellow Nobel laureates wouldn't engage with this book. Mm-hmm. They weren't ready for this. But he wrote it for wonderful reasons. He said, well, I am a secular Jew, but I did a very un-Jewish thing. I married a black Episcopalian lady.
Oh, my goodness.
And she died some time ago, and he missed her. Mm-hmm. And he said, I realized the reason I was proud of my children was because of what she had taught them, not what I had taught them.
Hmm.
And, of course, what she had taught was virtue.
Yeah. What a testimony that was.
And then I had a chance to talk to him about Deuteronomy 6, of course.
Right.
Which is, you know, the heart of Judaism, and it's about childcare.
Right.
Fathers teaching the stories to their children. Now we've produced a biblically illiterate generation, and we expect them to behave as though they're not.
Yeah.
You and I grew up with the fear of the Lord, in the good sense.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lovely example of how that works just at Christmas. My daughter is a missionary in Malawi. Her second son is a very tough little character, and he doesn't like the idea of school. And he knew that his mother was softer than he was, so he's given her a hard time in many ways over the last 7 or 8 years. And his younger sister has been the butt of his sometimes malicious fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day around Christmas, his little sister said to my daughter, Daniel's been very nice to me today. I don't know why. And Joanna went to Daniel later in the day and said, I'm very glad to hear Kalina said you've been nice to her today. Why is that? And he looked at her a little bit sheepishly and said, well, I woke up this morning and I thought, if I met Jesus now, I'd be in trouble. I thought I'd better change. And that change has continued for the next, 2.5 months.
Wow.
He's working harder. Something has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have seen that sort of thing as we grew up. That fear, which is not bad,
right,
has been good.
Yeah.
The voice behind you saying, not that way, this way.
Right. Or if I died tonight, what would happen to me?
Yeah. Of course, the secular psychologists tell you how terrible that is, but of course, the next bit they don't believe,
yeah,
that you can be set free from all fear.
Right, absolutely. Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Let's touch just a moment. You've been here at CMDA speaking on reductionism.
Yeah.
How about that for just 2 or 3 minutes? Well, I know that's impossible. Whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it's been recorded, so perhaps the thing to say is Edward Tingley has done utilitarianism,
mm-hmm,
and why it's a disaster and how to talk about it. And I was talking about reductionism, which is the basis of science, and it's adequate for science, but don't think that it gives you an overarching approach to life. It doesn't. We are not reducible to our biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
We are spiritual beings, and anyone who doesn't recognize that has a problem. Darwinism is in trouble with metaphysics. It has no explanation for altruism, and yet we all need it. We all cry for mercy, but there's no mercy in nature. All the immaterial things that cannot be reduced, love and truth and justice and honor, they're the ones that matter most. The other thing, can I put in another plug for Augustine as well?
Absolutely.
This is really to say thank you to many people in this organization who have sent us their young people. And this is an easy way to tell them that we were wondering this year what we'd do next year, as our property that we've rented for the last 10 years may not be continuing to be our property.
Hmm.
We don't know that for certain, and we are praying about it. And then God sent us for the first time over 20 students for the year.
Wow.
So he's saying, that's okay, you need a bigger property, and presumably he knows where it is. But that's really exciting, along with the continuing fact that our alumni hold on to their faith when they go to school. The university doesn't get them down.
Yeah. And I've seen that again and again. I don't know how many testimonies I've heard from students and others, and more and more people sending their kids there.
Yep.
And saying, hey, we need to give them some fire insurance before we send them into
that's
the
right.
flames.
Yes, that's right. Train them up and then they'll know. And it's such a joy to do as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we got, there was alumnus and his dad here, and a student for next year and her dad here, and several people have been to Augustine conferences in Ottawa, so we need to get more churches to invite us to come and talk to them.
Sure. That'd be a great thing for our members to do. They often have the access to get that
to make that happen.
Make that happen, absolutely. Well, John, thank you. As usual, you've taken us all over a lot of topics and challenged our minds and given us a lot of great ideas. And if people want to get more information about Augustine College, where
can they go? Just go to the website, augustinecollege.org, or go to my website, johnpatrick.ca, and there's a link between the two.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, wasn't it good to sit down with John? And I want to encourage you a couple of resources. One, you may not have gotten to the Augustine College at CMDA in February of 2010, but you can get the CDs. It's Dr. John Patrick and Dr. Edward Tingley, one of the professors there at Augustine College, and both of them were just superb. This is a 10-CD set, which I think you would love to just stick in your player in your car when you're on a trip, or have it going at your house when you're doing something else. You'll just really learn a lot, and I think it'll be very helpful to you. Also want to recommend Thinking Doctor's Library 2. These are six of John's favorite books that he's now really saying all of us should be reading. One's called The Beginnings of Western Science. Another is For the Glory of God. Third one, Jacob and the Prodigal, Intellectuals, and The Island of the World, which is actually a novel, and A Refutation of Moral Relativism. All highly recommended by John. We put them into a library. All these resources are available at shopcmda.org, or you can give us a toll-free call at 888-230-2637. I think all of us need to be growing our minds and staying relevant to what's going on in our world, and these resources will equip you in ways better than any other I know. So I hope you'll avail yourself of them.